Today in Studio 360, you're the most famous truth teller and cultural figure in America. Everybody wants to read your autobiography, but there's a catch. They've got to wait 100 years.
I speak from the grave rather than with my living tongue for a good reason. I can speak thence freely.
Mark Twain has finally published his autobiography. Later in the show, one of America's most interesting living writers, James Ellroy, tells me the secret to his successful career writing modern, ultra-noir potboilers.
I ignore the world. I lie in the dark and I brood.
And we continue our series on American icons with a painter who made us all reimagine the American Southwest.
O'Keeffe liked to walk in the desert, and she'd started to notice bleached bones.
Georgia O'Keeffe picks up a cow skull and makes history. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, James Ellroy shares his formula for writing dark, weird, riveting, one-of-a-kind fiction.
I love language. I love racial invective. I love Yiddish. I love alliteration. I love jazz musician patois. I love that stuff.
But first, another American legend who's not afraid to speak his mind.
Look at the candidates. Whom we loathe one year and are afraid to vote against the next. Look at the tyranny of party. And what is called party allegiance? Party loyalty. A snare invented by designing men for selfish purposes, and which turns voters into chattels, slaves, rabbits, and all the while their masters and they themselves are shouting rubbish about liberty, independence, freedom of opinion, freedom of speech, honestly unconscious of the fantastic contradiction.
A blogger ranting about last week's elections? Nope. Try again. 105 years ago, Mark Twain dictated those words as part of his autobiography. But almost nobody has seen the complete version of the autobiography until now. This week, the University of California Press is bringing out the first of three volumes. And it's huge.
Yes, it is a fat first volume. It's almost 800 pages. And I mean, if we made it much longer, we couldn't bind the book.
Robert Hurst is one of the editors of the autobiography. And to be honest, it's a bit of a sprawling collage full of tangents. It's really an uncensored window into Twain's mind. Sometimes hilarious, sometimes amazingly modern, sometimes a little hard to follow.
He decides in 1906 that he's not going to create a cradle-to-grave narrative. He's not going to say, I was born in 1835, et cetera, et cetera. He's simply going to stand up there and talk to the stenographer about whatever he's interested in. He's going to change the subject whenever he wants to. And he's going to create these dictations, which are, in a sense, random strikes at pieces of his life.
Now, Mark Twain wanted this published 100 years after his death. What thoughts were milling in his head at that time that he didn't want his contemporaries, or for that matter, his children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren, to read?
The kinds of things he's concerned about are basically criticisms that he's going to make of people like his publishers, people who have some against whom he has some animus. And he doesn't want, I mean, Mark Twain's rather tender-hearted. He does not want to hurt their feelings. He simply wants to be able to say exactly what he feels. And it's actually something that he decides to do quite early, 1876, the earliest mention we have of the autobiography. He's intending to have it published posthumously for exactly this reason.
Really? In 1876, when he was still not, he was 40 and not all that famous yet. I guess just famous.
Well, just famous. He hadn't published Huck yet, but he published Tom Sawyer.
Yep.
And his idea of the autobiography was actually quite well-formed early on. It took quite a while to get it done. Now, I think it's not too cynical to say that it also...
It was a good stunt.
It is also part of what I would call a business plan. I mean, if you tell someone they can't read something for 100 years,
yes.
they're going to get interested. And that is exactly what has happened.
In this autobiography, I shall keep in mind the fact that I am speaking from the grave. I am literally speaking from the grave because I shall be dead when the book issues from the press. I speak from the grave rather than with my living tongue for a good reason. I can speak thence freely. It has seemed to me that I could be as frank and free and unembarrassed as a love letter if I knew that what I was writing would be exposed to no eye until I was dead and unaware and indifferent.
No, one of the most interesting things beyond the odd insults to the Rockefeller family, or the fact admitting he lied to get out of a duel, and all these interesting revelations, is the kind of experimental quality of it as a work of literature. I mean, and it makes you think of, or made me think of, Mark Twain in a different way. Here he is in 1906, just as modern art is emerging and modernism is emerging, and here he creates this kind of modernist artifact.
You're absolutely right. Now, Mark Twain is one of the most experimental of writers. That's not well recognized, partly because a lot of the experiments were not published. But the fact is, he's a very forward-looking writer. I mean, in a way, very modern, and he was trying out something that is, in his eyes, I mean, he thinks this is going to be the way all autobiographies will be written in the future.
He does mention over and over again all of the sins that he needs to confess, the thousands that he'll forget to confess.
Yeah.
It seems to be being played at least partially, if not mainly, for humor. But was he racked with guilt about his imperfections?
The subject of things that he was ashamed of comes up because he starts out with the grand ambition of being able to put everything on paper, I mean, to be absolutely frank and not hide anything. And he discovers, really, after working at it for a number of years and also after the first few months of dictation, that he can't do that. He's not a confessional autobiographer like Rousseau. I mean, it's one thing not to be able to talk about shameful things, and it's another thing to be simply frank about the things and honest about the things that you can talk about.
The drunken tramp mentioned in Tom Sawyer or Huck Finn, who was burned up in the village jail, lay upon my conscience 100 nights afterwards and filled them with hideous dreams. Dreams in which I saw his appealing face as I had seen it in the pathetic reality, pressed against the window bars with the red hell glowing behind him. A face which seemed to say to me, "If you had not given me the matches, this would not have happened. You are responsible for my death." I was not responsible for it, for I had meant him no harm, but only good when I let him have the matches. But no matter, mine was a trained Presbyterian conscience, and knew but the one duty, to hunt and harry its slave upon all pretexts and on all occasions, particularly when there was no sense nor reason in it. The tramp, who was to blame, suffered 10 minutes. I, who was not to blame, suffered 3 months.
Mark Twain comes out of an oral tradition in American humor. The stories are passed from person to person orally. And he is the person who, in 1865, starts to turn that tradition into something that's actually written. And between 1865 and 1885, when he publishes Huck, he does an enormously creative job at doing that. Now, the other thing is that his whole style in the beginning is a plain style. It's meant to be a style that is freed from all the filigree of Victorian prose.
And so I suppose the attraction to anybody who's ever read Mark Twain and liked him is, here's a whole lot of Mark Twain you've never read and can sort of sink into like a warm bath.
That is exactly right. And I think the only caution I would make is that if, as you go through it, you occasionally hit passages that you think you've read before, you probably have. You just never read them in the way that Mark Twain wanted you to read them. You've read them either out of order or in a quotation or something like that.
It was a heavenly place for a boy, that farm of my Uncle John's. The way that the things were cooked were perhaps the main splendor, particularly a certain few of the dishes. For instance, the cornbread. The North thinks it knows how to make cornbread, but this is a gross superstition. Perhaps no bread in the world is quite as good as Southern cornbread. And perhaps no bread in the world is quite so bad as the Northern imitation of it.
It seems to me he would probably be tweeting and updating his Facebook page a lot and blogging like crazy, do you think?
Well, certainly some of those things. I'm not sure how much of it he could have endured. I'm not sure how much I can endure.
Oh, I would put Mark Twain's Twitters on my feed, though, certainly. I hope.
Well, sure you would. Sure you would. But the fact is he is fascinated by all kinds of communication devices. There is a dictation in here that I think has not been published in which he discovers somewhere that that someone has invented a wireless telephone.
And right.
He says the wireless telephone even has a recorder, you know, so that you can leave the message in when the person isn't there, and it doesn't even have to go through the central switchboard so nobody can gossip about what it was all about. And it's a kind of small portrait of his interest in investing and in inventions of this kind.
Investing in the cell phone fortune in 1900.
Yeah, well, there you are. He would be right on top of it. Certainly be kicking himself if he didn't.
You have spent almost your entire career working on Mark Twain,
yes.
His papers and his letters. As a Twain completist, what is there a single thing in this autobiography that you think, my God, I'm so happy to be bringing this to the world's attention?
I don't have a favorite. The fact of the matter is he's just marvelously wonderful to hear talking. And he cannot go 5 minutes without saying something funny and without giving you a kind of account of whatever it is he's talking about that is just marvelously Mark Twain.
Robert Hirsch, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I've achieved my 70 years in the usual way, by sticking strictly to a scheme of life which would kill anybody else. When we examine the program of any of these garrulous old people, we always find that the habits which have preserved them would have decayed us. I will offer here as a sound maxim this, that we can't reach old age by another man's road.
That was Rob Holliday reading from Mark Twain's autobiography, and Robert Hirsch is one of the book's editors. It's in bookstores this week. Coming up, we'll head to New Mexico, where Georgia O'Keeffe started her new life and a lifelong obsession.
The bones do not symbolize death to me. They are shapes that I enjoy. It never occurs to me that they have anything to do with death. They are very lively.
Georgia O'Keeffe picks up a cow skull and makes history. That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Georgia O'Keeffe always considered herself a Western woman. She grew up on a Wisconsin dairy farm in the 1890s and taught school in Texas. She never felt quite at home when she lived in New York City during the Roaring Twenties, even though she was a successful painter and had a famous artist husband, the photographer Alfred Stieglitz. Only in her 40s did O'Keeffe discover the subject that defined her, the old animal bones that littered the deserts of New Mexico. She continued to paint them until she died at age 98. To understand why those sun-dried bones took such a hold on O'Keeffe and generations of her fans, we will start with Lisa Messenger, who's a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
In 1929, Georgia O'Keeffe decides that her life has sort of fallen apart. Her marriage to Stieglitz is rocky. He's having affairs. She also felt, I think just personally for her art, that she'd lost her passion for what she was painting. She was kind of having a nervous breakdown. And I guess to bring herself out of it, she decided to accept an invitation to Taos, New Mexico. And that was it. She went up. It turned her whole life around.
As soon as I saw it, that was my country. I'd never seen anything like it before, but it fitted to me exactly.
That's Georgia O'Keeffe speaking in a 1977 documentary.
Just different. The sky is different. The stars are different. The wind is different. I shouldn't say too much about this because other people may get interested and I don't want them interested.
It's hard to look at New Mexico without seeing an O'Keeffe painting in every direction.
My name is Carol Merrill. I worked with Georgia O'Keeffe for 7 years, from 1973 to 1979. And I was her caregiver, cook, nurse, companion, confidant. I would walk with her, talk with her.
There, that little building beyond is the O'Keeffe house.
I wrote her a letter, and she answered the letter, and her letter back to me said, "Dear stranger," and it was one sentence, and it was, "Whenever you can find your way up here, let us know."
I'm Wanda Korn, and I'm a historian of American art, and I have a very special interest in the artists of the early 20th century, artists like Georgia O'Keeffe.
I remember talking with a little girl when I was 12, and I said, "Lena, what are you going to do when you grow up?" Well, she didn't know. Well, I said, "I'm going to be a painter."
O'Keeffe made her first trip in 1929 to Taos, and she got interested in property there. She began to go back to the same house, a small adobe house in a dude ranch called Ghost Ranch. And then she bought a hacienda in a little village called Abiquiu.
And on the windowsill, there would be all of these little rocks and shells and bones. And at some time, I commented on how the bones made me think about dead stuff. And she said, "No, that was once alive."
O'Keeffe liked to walk in the desert, and she'd pick up rocks that she enjoyed, or she started to notice bleached bones from animals that had been killed and left behind. So she'd pick up these bones and bring them home with her, not knowing quite what she would do with them. So on the second summer, she packed up a barrel in which she put some of the skulls that she'd picked up on the desert, and she sent it to herself in Lake George, New York, for the summer.
That's where I began. That's where I painted my first skulls, from this barrel of bone. And first I painted a horse's head, and then I got this cow's head. And I had the cow's head painted against the blue.
O'Keeffe's painting hangs in the Metropolitan Museum, and it's called Cow's Skull, Red, White, and Blue.
It's a large, white, very rugged, chipped-looking cow's skull smack in the middle of the painting,
with its two horns splayed out to the left and to the right.
There's a black band down the middle of the painting that I think really is probably the easel. And then in the middle it's blue, like looks kind of sky-like.
And then two red stripes, one on either side of the painting.
And that was at the time that the men were all talking about the great American novel, the great American play, the great American, oh, it was the great American everything. And I thought they didn't know anything about America. A lot of them had never been across the Hudson. So I thought, I'll make my picture a red, white, and blue. I'll make it an American painting.
When O'Keeffe showed the skull paintings for the first time, the audience for them was a New York audience. It was the same audience that she had been drawing for her flower painting for the last 10 years or so. And the critics discuss the flower paintings as if they could only come from a feminine gaze or speaker. And this became a little tiresome to her because she felt as if what she painted was always tied to her sexuality and not at all thought as male art was, as something coming from an independent spirit. One critic wrote a very little review, but he just didn't even mention the bone paintings, as if he couldn't find a vocabulary that would put femaleness and bones together in some inherent way. And somebody called them gruesome trophies in a sort of headline story. And she wrote to one of her friends saying, "You know, I'm just simply not doing what these critics say I'm doing. I'm trying to get a sense of place. I want to get some kind of sense," in other words, to give some kind of westernness to her work.
I mean, if you're aware of her bone pictures, then when you see a skull or a bone, you rethink that image and you think of O'Keeffe. We're going down to the vault. My name is Barbara Bueller-Lines, and I'm the curator at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum. We're going to the lower area of the Research Center. We have in our materials here at the Research Center a variety of types of bones that she collected. You gonna pull that one out?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a deer skull. So they were around the house. And this is, I think, probably a cow's skull. It looks like a cow's skull, maybe a steer. People saw them as symbols of death because traditionally bones are symbols of death. And so they were seen as, you know, in that way when they were first exhibited in New York, her paintings of bones. And she, you know, refuted that.
The bones do not symbolize death to me. They are shapes that I enjoy. It never occurs to me that they have anything to do with death. They are very lively.
The problem with Georgia O'Keeffe is she often told you what things weren't about in her work, but she seldom told you what things were about. So you're left in a quandary for trying to interpret exactly what her work meant.
Now, when people travel now to northern New Mexico, they're often in search of Georgia O'Keeffe landscape. She always worked from nature. She didn't dream these things up. And so you can find many of her sites, and people sometimes do that as sport. They go and find out where did Georgia O'Keeffe stand, or where did Georgia O'Keeffe make her mental note of how these hills looked.
We are going to do the Georgia O'Keeffe landscape tour, and we travel in a small vehicle and show you folks specifically the different sites where O'Keeffe painted.
I mean, I started saying last year, Georgia O'Keeffe has been very good to us.
Okay, it's kind of hot today, huh?
So my name is Karen Butts, and I'm the Tourism Activities Coordinator here at Ghost Ranch in Abiquiu, New Mexico, and I lead the Georgia O'Keeffe Landscape Tour.
That's the original entrance road. So this is the way O'Keeffe, now you can pretend you're her in her little car, right? And of course, when you look out the window, you see that huge, beautiful wall. So these are the things she saw when she drove in.
Anybody who's remotely involved in the tourism industry, we're totally indebted to her.
So in any case, I want you to look out the window and you'll see the house. We're gonna pass it one more time. You'll notice there's a big old tan garage door.
She loved that it was remote. She loved that it was beautiful and quiet and open and natural and undeveloped. That's the same thing that draws a lot of us here.
But she's fascinating, isn't she? Yeah.
So what kind of work did she do after she started losing her
vision? It's not just, you know, middle age or later middle age women we get on the tour, but there is certainly a noticeable quantity of them that come and attend the tour. They want to try and get a sense, I think, of what drove her or what inspired her.
I'm Noreen Perlmutter, and I grew up in New York. I was born in the Bronx, and then a year ago, we retired and moved to Santa Fe. I lived the Southwest through her paintings.
You look at it and it's almost painted for you, you think, until you try. I tried to paint what I saw.
I mean, when I came to the Southwest, I really expected that the Southwest would look like her paintings, and they don't. Her landscapes are way better in some ways, so it was a shock to sort of see it for the first time.
There's a strip of color, you don't see it because it's in shadow now, but there's a strip of pink, red, and yellow that goes all along over a very long way that I've put in at the foot of my hill.
In my 30s, early 30s, my best friend Fran was coming to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, and she said, is there anything you want me to bring back? And I said, can you bring me back a skull? So she comes home, and she had this beautiful white bleached skull, and there it was hanging in my house in Long Island. It loomed. It was beautiful. And then years later, I retired and I came to Santa Fe, and you know, I got rid of almost everything in my house when we came, except for books and clothes, but I brought my skull. How could you not?
O'Keeffe, she would have seen cow skulls used to mark a dude ranch. A dude ranch might have a sign of its name, and over it, it would hang a skull. And as she began to polish them up and bring them to New York as finished paintings, people began to catch on that these were rather beautiful objects. So although she would hate to have done this to the bone, she in fact was the beginnings of a new regional decoration, what today is called the Santa Fe style.
I don't think people think their house is complete unless they have like a cow skull hanging on it. My name is Chris Lajeski, and I'm an interior designer. I have my own firm headquartered in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, the five essentials of a Santa Fe home is a Navajo rug, a cow skull, you know, a Native American pot. Everybody has a turquoise necklace and a framed George O'Keeffe poster. You know, I'll do very sophisticated interiors or a beach house where everything is really stark white. And then you put the skull up there and it becomes a really sophisticated piece of, you know, it's an accessory, but it's like a little art piece.
Today, skulls are an utter cliche in New Mexico. There's been such a commercialization of the skull that it's lost its kind of authenticity.
It's almost like she became pop art. You know, everyone used her. And I got very upset when I realized that she wasn't mine. For me, George O'Keeffe and the skull are interchangeable. It is the essence of her. It is the rawness. It is everything that she's about.
If O'Keeffe were with us today, she would be very surprised about what has happened to her vocabulary that she invented for the Southwest. She kind of carved out a special space, regional space, for the Southwest as opposed to the Wild West. As her paintings became better known by the American public, the mesas, the lava hills, the churches, and the bones, all of this became identified, thanks to the popularity of her paintings, as the Southwest's special area, all on its own, separate from the vast American West.
She actually said to me one day that in 100 years you can't know if anybody will even know who she was or anything about her or even care about her art.
But it happens that the thing that I have done, the things that I've been doing have been in touch with my time so that people have liked it. But I could have been much better and nobody noticed it. Much better, I'll say, as a painter. Some people seem to be luckier than others. I don't know, maybe it's because I've taken hold of anything that came along that I wanted.
When I think of O'Keeffe, I think of it as the enormous courage it took to do what she did. She talks about that her life has been like standing on the edge of a knife.
On this knife, I might fall off on either side, but I'd walk it again. So what? What if you do fall off? I'd rather be doing something I really wanted to do.
I hope we keep struggling to try to figure out what she was up to. And I think there are little gifts that she left along the way in her words, but mostly in her art. And it's a mystery, and I love the mystery of it. I can never know the whole story, and that's fine.
Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler produced our story for American Icons. You can see some of their photos from Abiquiu, New Mexico at studio360.org/American Icons. And of course, some images of George O'Keeffe's skull paintings as well. Hundreds of artists today continue to share O'Keeffe's deep connection to the landscape of the American West. It's one of her greatest legacies. Last month, a group of painters gathered in northern Arizona to paint pictures of the Grand Canyon. For a week, they worked outside in the open air right along the rim in front of tourists and anybody else who wandered by. Now those paintings are on display at Grand Canyon National Park through November, and Daniel Crocker of Arizona Public Radio went to check them out.
Bruce Aiken is perched on a rock, sketchbook in hand. His long gray hair is pulled back under a yellow bandana. He looks pretty relaxed, although if he lost his balance, he'd be lying at the edge of a 4,000-foot drop. Visitors look over his shoulder as he sketches a giant rock formation called Isis Temple.
I feel like I'm just visiting an old friend again and getting to know her lines and curves. Again, one more time.
A lot of the artists at the Grand Canyon Celebration of Art have been painting the canyon for years, but nobody knows it better than Aiken. For 33 years, he lived deep inside it. He ran a pump house for the National Park Service, raised his kids there, and painted constantly.
During that time, I never stopped my studies of the canyon. I had it firsthand. I had it right outside the front door, right out my bedroom window. The sounds and the rhythms of the canyon owned me.
He's obsessed. When Aiken first visited the Grand Canyon, he only had one thought. How could he live here?
Now, I know there's a lot of other artists that come here, and all they want to do is get an artistic interpretation off this in one stylistic approach, and done. Then they're done. Then they can move on and go on to the next subject. It wasn't that way for me.
In 1970, Aiken was an art student steeped in abstract expressionism. Jackson Pollock, Frank Stella. He felt he had to study the canyon before he even tried to paint it, from the geology and plant life to the way the rock looks when the sun hits it at a certain angle. Once he started painting it, a distinct style emerged, a sharp realism with bright colors that jump off the canvas.
All I'm trying to do is say, this is what I saw, this is what I think I'm seeing, I think this is interesting and beautiful. There it is. If you like it, great. If you don't, doesn't matter, because I'm still going to dig out more.
Back in the late 1800s, painters like Thomas Moran made epic canvases of the Western landscape and brought them around the East Coast. These were the first images most Americans ever saw of the Grand Canyon or Yellowstone, and they helped inspire Congress to create the National Park System. Back then, conservation was seen as a kind of patriotism.
Not in a Pollyanna sort of way. We're not flag wavers. But when I look at the Grand Canyon, or I look at Yellowstone, or I look at the Southwest deserts, and I physically go out into those places, I'm engaging in a primary act as a citizen of this country to pay homage to my landscape. And the paintings that I do are expressions of my status as an American citizen.
That's landscape painter Peter, or P.A. Nesbitt. It sounds kind of hokey, but looking out over the Grand Canyon, you know what he means.
Just the fact that I paint it requires that I observe it very closely. And the more you look, the more you will appreciate, and the more you appreciate, the more you'll protect it.
Oh, yes, that's a nice one. I like that one, too.
Nesbitt has just finished his piece for the Quick Draw event, where artists have to complete a painting in under 2 hours. The event is a fundraiser for the park, and an odd mix of art collectors, hikers, and tourists is scribbling down notes and deciding what to bid on.
This is called View from Carly Point. How about $500 to start? $500 to go. $500, thank you, now $550. $500.
There's no shortage of bidders.
There's $1,900, $1,950, $1,950 and $2,000. $1,950 and $2,000, she's determined, I love it. You betcha.
Proceeds from this auction will help the National Park build a permanent venue to display its pretty impressive art collection, which is now locked up in storage.
Last call at $2,000, going once. Going twice. Everybody say the S word with me together on three. One, two, three. Sold! 1950.
Afterwards, Nesbitt meets the determined woman who won his painting, Lee Schmidt, also from Santa Fe.
No one was going to outbid.
That's right, she was totally set.
No one was going to.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming, for doing it. I feel like I robbed someone to get it at that price. Now, no one was.
Phoenix Art Museum director Jim Ballinger is a judge at the event. He says that artists like Peter Nesbitt and Bruce Aiken give you a sense of the sublime, which is hard to find in the art world these days.
A lot of contemporary art is about art, you know, and it's abstract, and it's about conception, and it's looking inside. Here you have artists that are still looking for beauty in the world, and there's a big argument in the last 20 years in contemporary art that beauty shouldn't even be part of art anymore.
That was news to me. But Merrill Mahaffey's heard it before. He's in his 70s and probably the best known artist here, and he likes his paintings beautiful.
I know it's not considered serious, but...
It's not considered serious?
No, beautiful painting. Get out of here.
So are you being serious when you say that some people might kind of scoff at a beautiful painting because of what doesn't have a serious enough message?
Yeah, the whole art world. The beauty was expressed by the Renaissance and classical culture, and now we have to move on to other things, push the envelope. I tried that for a while.
Seems like a paradox, but these days it takes a Western individualist, a guy tough enough to go against the grain, to paint a beautiful picture.
It would be dishonest to say that I'm too tough and too sophisticated not to just fall down when I see something beautiful.
For Studio 360, I'm Daniel Crocker.
And at studio360.org, you can see images of these new Grand Canyon paintings and find out about the exhibit in Arizona. Coming up, after decades of churning out modern noir blockbusters, novelist James Ellroy has not mellowed in the slightest.
You want to be mellow? You want to be mellow, you know, then turn yourself into a piece of cheese. The trouble with being a piece of cheese is that someone is likely to spread you on a cracker and eat you. No, I'm not mellowing. No.
The novelist James Ellroy, that's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, dedicated to freedom of expression, nurturing creativity, and encouraging originality. Individualism reigns at Scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. James Ellroy is a piece of work. Most famous for his Los Angeles crime novels, including L.A. Confidential, he writes in a hard-boiled, super-edgy, pedal-to-the-metal style that is singular. People who like his fiction love it. He's got a new memoir out now called Hilliker's Curse, My Pursuit of Women, and it's exactly what it sounds like. When I talked to him last year, Ellroy's adventures with the opposite sex came up a lot. At the time, he had just published Blood's a Rover, which is the third in a trilogy that depicts this dark, alternate history of the 1960s. It was full of crooked police, crooked politicians, cold-blooded killers, mobsters, various sickos, and right-wing thugs. James Ellroy, welcome to Studio 360.
Good to be here. You forgot to mention the women, my greatest women characters ever.
If you don't say so yourself, as you're inclined to do.
As I am inclined to say so myself. I require very little prompting.
Do you believe, for instance, personally, do you actually believe, James Ellroy, that mobbed-up conspiracies killed the Kennedys and King as opposed to lone, crazy gunmen?
The spiritual genesis, the creative genesis of the Underworld USA trilogy, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, Blood's a Rover, is Don DeLillo's 1988 novel, Libra, in which he posits the unholy trinity of renegade CIA guys, not the CIA as an entity, right-wing Cuban exiles, and the mob, whack JFK. That was my starting point for this epic pop history of America. It was entirely real to me, and if it didn't happen, c'est la guerre, it's got the F on the spine for fiction.
In this era of cable news and internet everything, it seems as if there are a lot more people with some kind of dark, weird, fabulized, James Ellroy-ish view of the world. I wonder how that strikes you as a kind of cultural fact.
I know it exists in the zeitgeist, and I capitalize on it in my books. Now, I don't have a cell phone. I'm computer illiterate. I've never been on the internet. Alfred Akinoff, my publisher, required me to get a Facebook page, which I utilize. I don't have a television set.
Have people friended you on Facebook yet?
I have numerous friends on Facebook. Yeah, I met the woman who was the love of my life on Facebook. I had met her previously, but she friended me on Facebook.
Well, now there's value in the internet. Maybe you'll become a user.
Yeah, but she's the love of my life. I never have to find another woman.
Well, there you go.
But moving along, I ignore the world. Mm-hmm. I live in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. I don't watch TV. I don't read the newspapers. I don't go to movies. I lie in the dark and I brood. I think about deep, dark, tortured, historical shit.
But does it also, do you think, by staying out of the loop in that way, allow you to sort of remain as a something of a museum piece? I mean, you have the way you speak often is like someone speaking in 1965.
I love language. I love racial invective. I love Yiddish. I love alliteration. I love jazz musician patois.
When you say you love racial invective, what does that mean?
I love racist language. I love that stuff.
And you say you find it funny, and as I'm reading along, I do too sometimes. But do you ever, as you're rewriting, as you're editing, do you go, geez, you know, I could take out every third one of these?
No, I never do.
No?
I never do. Because it's all contextual. Mm-hmm. I love going back and reliving history.
And when you were doing those early books, you had just come off, I guess, a decade of what sounds like a difficult decade of booze and drugs and petty crime and all that. Seeing what you've become, do you ever think, or I thought, he's sort of like our Genet. He's this, the gay part aside. He lived in this underworld and then came back to tell stories about it.
Didn't Genet, and I know nothing about him, so I'm relying on you for that, didn't he worship depravity?
Yes.
Yeah, I despise depravity. I'm a Christian. I'm very conservative. And I hate the depraved. I hate the nihilistic. I hate pornography. I hate the abuse of children and women. I'm an authoritarian. You know, I'm about as far from Genet as you can get, except I'm bald.
The one thing you've said in other interviews that you allow into your kind of media culture-free bubble is classical music. You listen to classical music, yeah? What do you listen to?
The romantic composers, chiefly. The artist who has most moved me and most taught me in my lifetime, the most unfathomable genius ever created by civilization, is Beethoven. I've learned more from listening to Beethoven obsessively for 40-odd years than reading any other writer.
It seems about right. Listening to Beethoven obsessively, you know.
My girlfriend, a brilliant woman, said Beethoven had to go deaf to shut the world out. It's a great perception.
You are 61 now?
That's correct.
Do you feel any different in terms of your mellowing or any other of those kinds of things?
You want to be mellow, you know, then turn yourself into a piece of cheese. The trouble with being a piece of cheese is that someone is likely to spread you on a cracker and eat you. No, I'm not mellow.
So as you come closer to the end, some grand old man wisdom is not descending upon you.
I'm 6'3", I weigh 175, and I can kick your ass.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm 6'2", and got a couple of pounds on you, but, you know.
I bite. I sharpen my teeth on a pumice stone.
Gotcha.
I floss with barbed wire. And I gargle with the AIDS virus.
My goodness. Ah! What a transgressive gentleman you are.
I'm a good guy, Ashley. I'm a sweetheart.
I bet you are. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for such a good interview this early in the book tour on a very hot day in LA.
Happy to provide a service. James Elroy, with whom I spoke last year. His latest book is called Hilliker's Curse, My Pursuit of Women. James Elroy's violent, sexy, dark fiction has inspired writers all over the world, including, it turns out, in Israel. It's a country that hasn't really had much of a homegrown noir until now. The novel Allenby is about the aftermath of a crime at a Tel Aviv nightclub. It's a graphic, violent look at Israel's underclass. And Allenby's author, Gadi Taub, leads a kind of double life, not unlike some of his characters. He's best known as a public intellectual whose op-eds about religious settlers on the occupied West Bank are published in the New York Times. But to relax, Taub likes to go to a place called Allenby 40, the real-life dive that the tourist guidebooks describe as Tel Aviv's sleaziest bar. Taub told producer Michael May that that's where he did all the research for his novel.
So in through the rabbit hole, eh? Welcome to Allenby.
Gadi Taub leads the way, pushing the door open and entering the club. It's dark as a cave. A tall, striking Ethiopian woman leans over to greet him. She grins wickedly as she whispers in his ear. A few people are grinding on the dance floor under flashing red disco lights.
So this is very mellow now, because it's early. It's just 1 a.m. It's not even starting yet.
By 3 a.m., this place will be full of one of the most colorful crowds in Tel Aviv. It's where strippers come to unwind after a night's work, as well as immigrant laborers, Arabs, and Orthodox Jews. It's a place most Israeli elites would avoid. But Taub says he found it a welcome escape from trendy Tel Aviv.
That was the start. You know, even very fat girls wear tank tops here. So it's, you don't have to be polished and self-aware in the sense that you are in like the in clubs. And that was such an incredible relief.
As Taub got to know the regulars at Allenby 40, they became his friends. And he began to write his novel based on a real event he witnessed at the club. Late one night, he saw a man viciously pummel a woman on the dance floor.
I said, in all my days in Allenby, I've seen girls beating, but I haven't seen any other incident of any girl getting beaten by a guy. This was not like pushed around. This was beating.
I asked Taub to read that scene from the novel.
In the middle, a girl with blood on her chin. Convulsing, eyes shut tight, crying, shoulders shaking. The girls held her all around, showed her out like she was blind. They pushed through the exit, regrouped around her near the wall, outside the railing. Alex followed, walkie-talkie over his head, pushed into the pack. Excuse me, move it. Worse than he thought, the girl's palm was under her chin, blood, spit, broken teeth in it.
Taub begins the novel with that scene, and then unravels the web of relationships that exist between the regulars of Allenby 40, relationships that form at 4 a.m. and rarely stay happy for long.
This kind of relationship where men are drawn to something that they feel is wild about certain women, and then they can't live with that. What they try to do immediately is domesticate the very thing that they were drawn to because it wasn't domesticated. So that became, I guess, an intense interest. And I dated a stripper for a while. And that's not a kind of relationship that's a good recipe for peaceful night's sleeps.
Taub writes the book from a distinctly male point of view. And he makes no apologies for his character's sexist, violent, and racist actions. It was a risk. Many Israelis felt it was over the top. Aliyah is a cashier at the Jerusalem bookstore Steimatsky's. She only made it through 30 pages of the book.
It's good that he wants to open our eyes, but I couldn't read the book because it was too, disgusting.
Gadi Taub is not surprised by the reaction. He says Israelis aren't used to this kind of literature. He's inspired by American writers like Raymond Carver and James Ellroy, and he explicitly rejected the dominant Israeli style, which is self-conscious and more about emotions than actions.
So in a setting where people's teeth get smashed, there's no time and no energy, and it's even risky to be sentimental or too self-indulgent.
That's an attitude he also brings to his nonfiction and op-eds. Lately, he's been arguing a new direction for Zionism. So fans of his academic writing have been surprised by the novel. Allenby takes place in the weeks after Prime Minister Ariel Sharon collapsed into a coma. But the characters respond to the news like it's happening in another universe.
And it was important for me that it would happen in the distance because their idea of politics is very vague. And politics is what you become passionate about when you realize the connection between your own life and the political system.
Taub hopes that readers get the message.
The problem is that if you live without any social networks to support you, then this is how you end up living.
And when the English translation is eventually published here, we'll see how Israeli pulp fiction sounds to American readers, for whom sex, violence, and a seething underclass are nothing new. For Studio 360, I'm Michael May.
Although Gadi Taub's fiction isn't available in English yet, his new nonfiction book, The Settlers, is, and it's out right now. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. One last heads up to our New York listeners. We've got a special live show coming up at WNYC's Green Space. The amazing comedian-musician Reggie Watts will attempt to unlock the secrets of the universe. Really? That's Monday evening, December 13th at 7 o'clock. You can find out how to get tickets at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Michael Guerriero,
Max Bass,
Julia Botero,
Georgette Pierre.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and thanks this week and every week to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org. And by Scion. Scion offers options that let everyone express his or her creativity to customize their car to fit their lives. Creativity begins at scion.com. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the writer Salman Rushdie. In his new book, a boy has to save his storyteller father. It's a magic carpet ride that echoes Rushdie's real life. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.